Hello, everybody. This is Bill Knauer, and you're listening to Author, where we talk about writing and life, because what it takes to write the book you want to write is also what it takes to lead the life you want to lead. It's true. It's true. Author to Author is brought to you by Author Magazine, the premier free writing magazine on the internet, featuring articles on writing and the writing life, as well as some video interviews with best-selling and award-winning authors across the genres. We've got a great interview up right now with Washington State Book Award winner Sharma Shields, who wrote the hilarious and intriguing Sasquatch Hunter's Almanac. We had a great conversation about creativity. You can check it out at authormagazine.org. And we are funded by the wonderful Pacific Northwest Writers Association, supporting writers from pen to publication since 1955. PNWA hosts a great writers' conference every summer here in the Northwest. They also have a wonderful writing contest if you're into contests. It's launched a few careers, I know, and they're just now starting to get the submissions in. So if you'd like to enter a piece of writing for really anything from memoir to romance to literary fiction to nonfiction to suspense, really all genres, including short fiction and poetry, cover all the genres and types of writing, go to pnwa.org and you can get all you need to send it in there. So it's pnwa.org. I should tell you quickly, if you're a fan of the show and if you've heard me do my Fearless Writing Masterclasses, which we'll be doing another one soon, I will be teaching a workshop, Fearless Writing Workshop, here in Seattle on February 18th, Saturday, February 18th. In the Wallingford District, if you know Seattle. But if you don't know it, go to williamknauer.com, click on Fearless Writing, and it'll guide you to the link for that workshop. I'd love to see you there. We can do it in person, answer all your most challenging questions. And if you are familiar with the show, you are probably familiar with today's guest, Mr. Mitch Horowitz, who's been on, well, I've had him on a few times already, and I'll bet I have him on a few times more. Mitch is, he's done a lot of stuff. He's a Penn Award-winning historian and is the author of several books, including Occult America. He's the author of One Simple Idea, How Positive Thinking Reshaped Modern Life, and, intriguingly, forthcoming, The Miracle of a Definite Chief Aim. Mitch has written on everything from the secret life of President Ronald Reagan to the war on witches for the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, Salon, Politico, and Time.com, and he is the host of Origins, Superstition, and a vice president and executive editor at Penguin Random House, where he is publishes authors living and dead, including David Lynch, Manly P. Hall, and Mr. Joseph Murphy, who I think we'll be talking about today. Mitch, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Mitch, you're such a busy guy, but you know what I like about your busyness? You do what you love. It seems to me. I don't want to put words to your
mouth. I've been fortunate.
You seem to be doing what you really love to do.
It's a blessing. It's a blessing. The writing and the speaking that I do really focuses on the topics that I'm most passionate about in my own life. I only write about a person or an idea or an event if I feel like that thing has the capacity to change me, to give me a different perspective on myself or on the world. So it's been a great blessing, and I do feel very fortunate to be able to immerse myself in these topics.
It's really cool being a writer and you write and speak, so you kind of, I assume you, in your mind perhaps, they're all kind of one body of work. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, definitely.
It's the same is true for me. I find this so cool that my job is to go and find out what's super interesting to me and explore it as deeply as possible. And if I do that, inevitably there are people out there who will also be interested.
Yes, I feel very strongly that that's true. You know, I can't imagine any of us is a complete iconoclast, and if you find something that you're passionate about, chances are you're going to find company. You know, it may be large company, it may be small company, but it is extremely important, I think, that an idea have a constituency, have an audience. I mean, we need to be able to involve other people in what we're doing. No artist wants to create his or her work in isolation. It's okay to do a few things in isolation. Sometimes, in fact, it's quite necessary. There's something deeply shaping of an individual, deeply refining, that can occur only in isolation. But the writer, the artist, the producer needs to go public at a certain point. It's very important, in fact, for the quality of your ideas to test them out in front of an audience. There's a process of refinement that goes on and that can go on in no other way than in public. I mean, we need both.
Yeah.
So if you find something that you're passionate about and that you're interested in, that in itself is a sure sign that you can't be entirely alone. There are others of a kind who are going to share that interest with you.
They will. And but you have to be willing to base your desire to share first and really only on your what I think of as unconditional love for that subject. In other words, you're interested in it simply because you're interested, not because of the what you think will come from whether monetary or attention or fame or whatever you think is going to come of it. It's unconditional, your interest in it.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's why I advise people to choose their aims and to choose their subject matter with great care, because passion at a certain point is the only thing that's going to pull you through. When people settle on a topic that they're not 100% dedicated to, 100% enthralled by, it's going to make it very, very tough to get through some demanding times that you're naturally going to face as a writer or in whatever work you do in life. The greatest guarantee that you're going to complete something, maybe the only guarantee that you're going to complete something, is having absolute passion for it.
Yeah, you know what it reminds me of is marriage, which is there's a lot of interesting, attractive people in the world.
Mm-hmm.
That who maybe like the same things you like and listen to the same music you listen to or whatever, but that does not mean you will be able to sustain a love relationship with them, because every love relationship is going to have those moments, like in a book, where when you're writing a book, you suddenly think you have an argument with it, and you think, I don't know, what is this book about? Am I going to be able to finish it? You got to love it to get through. And the same is true of a marriage. You're going to argue.
Right.
You're going to have all those moments.
Right, right. Choice of topic. Absolutely. It's you're entering into a deep-seated relationship of a sort, and likewise, in having an aim in life, whatever that aim may be, you have to be absolutely certain that there are intense emotions at the back of it. We talk about willpower. You know, I'm not really sure what willpower is, quite frankly. It's one of those terms that we sort of errantly throw around. But I do understand intense emotions. I do understand passionate emotions. And I understand the persistence that can arise from passionate emotions. You know, some of these terms that we throw around I don't relate to at all, and I suspect many people don't. You know, I never know quite what is meant by faith, but I understand what is meant by persistence, and I kind of equate the two. I actually find it easier when I come across the term faith to substitute the word persistence, and it's something I suggest to people who are confounded by a term like faith, which can seem quite amorphous.
Well, it got
like
co-opted.
Having faith in yourself, you know. It got co-opted, but, you know, if one says, you know, have faith in yourself, there may be dark nights where it's really very difficult for me to have faith in myself, but I do understand persistence, and I do understand that persistence will come if I feel something with a passionate emotional pitch. So I find those terms better to follow, clearer lines of reasoning than terms like faith or willpower. A lot of it really comes down to emotion, and emotion is just enormously important. And I also encourage people, you know, we hear that, you know, success can't compensate for failures in other parts of one's life or insecurities. And, you know, I challenge that thinking to a certain degree. I mean, obviously, if there's some crippling insecurity or there is some crippling sense of self-doubt, yes, it may be that needs to be dealt with head-on, if possible. But almost every artist, every creator, every producer has suffered some sort of shock in life that they feel they are addressing or recovering from or expressing their way through in the form of their art. You know, most actors would probably agree, for example, that whatever part they're playing, they are infusing that part, whatever it may be, with some universal emotional experience that has traveled throughout their lives. That's the reservoir they're drawing upon when they inhabit a character. And in inhabiting a character, they feel seen. They feel seen by the audience, and that can have tremendous benefits to an individual. And whether or not we ever resolve any of the great traumas of our lives, I'm not so sure. But I do think that work and art and productivity can, in fact, be an appropriate and even compensatory response to things that people have suffered through life. So, you know, that's another reason, I think, why our emotions are so bound up in our work, because sometimes we are trying to fill a hole, for example, that we feel in some other part of life. And I would say, don't let anybody take that away from you. Don't let anybody say to you that that's necessarily a problem or an act of evasion or something. You know, when we hear people say, you know, success can't solve other problems, well, you know, what can solve other problems? Because problems that we have in life sometimes seem to be an organic part of us, and responding to them through art or productivity can actually be a helpful and necessary outlet.
You know, I agree, and the metaphor, what's his name, the dog whisperer, that Cesar Millan. I saw him tell, he told a story about, he's a man who works with high-risk dogs and helping them come back to themselves in a way, and there was this one story about this dog that was extremely violent and had a very violent past and had been mistreated by some previous owners, and all his work with the dog was not helping. But then he had this idea. He knew it was a hunting dog, that's what the dog was bred to do. That was what it's. And so he got some, I don't know why he had any, but he had some raccoon urine, believe it or not. And he laid a trail. This story always moves me. He laid a trail of the raccoon urine. And when the dog set to hunting, it hadn't hunted in years, but when it set to hunting, it found itself again. It did what it meant to do. And so I find for myself that the work I love to do is like that raccoon urine, that it helps me bring me back to myself. It's not the success I get from the work, although that's very nice, but the act of doing it takes me back to what I feel I'm on the planet to do. It brings me back to my core self. Does that make sense?
I recognize that, I definitely recognize that. I felt the same way. I didn't publish – I'm 51 now. I didn't publish my first books until I was in my 40s. And so, you know, people often ask me, gee, where do you get all this energy from? You know, you seem like you're constantly on the go.
Right.
And, you know, part of that has to do with coming into my own sense of purpose somewhat late in life. And if you had spoken to me in my late 30s, I wouldn't have considered it a foregone conclusion by any stretch that I was going to be publishing books and writing and speaking so actively. So to come into that late in life, past the point where we're taught that maybe it's time to start settling, you know, for things, was to me a tremendously energizing experience, kind of like that dog. You know, there had been years of dormancy, and then a discovery of what I'm supposed to be actually doing, and the energy that comes from that for me has just been, frankly, phenomenal. You know, I have been able to dedicate time to my subjects, passion to my subjects, energy to my subjects that I wouldn't have known I had in me 15 years ago.
Well, you are singing my song, Mitch, because I too am 51 years old, and I too, although I've always wanted to write. Yeah, I am. I
what
did not know until my 40s what I actually wanted to write about. I did not.
That's funny.
I thought for most of my life it would be poetry or fiction, or which I loved, and if you told me I was writing what I'm writing now, which is really spiritual type writing, I guess would be the best description of it, I would have told you you're crazy, that was not what I did, it's not who I was. But once I found it, just like you described, I found a new energy and a new drive that really I had lost track of. I really had lost
track. That's very interesting.
I was really quite adrift. But that came in my 40s. So I'm like you, I came to it later, much later.
That's very interesting. That's very interesting.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's another reason why persistence is so important, because I mean, some people do. First of all, some people peak young, and that can be very exciting, but it can also be very difficult because then you have decades stretched out before you where it can be challenging to try to recapture that, or, you know, you spend the rest of your life doing that which you already know how to do. But I found that a lot of the people I work with, who are creating books and writing of real posterity, of lasting worth, very frequently, they're in our age range. I think there's a certain degree of discernment and strength and maturity that just takes time, you know, sometimes.
Well, could you have been doing what you're doing now when you were 25? Could you have, I mean, I know, I don't think I could have done it. It was in me, but I couldn't have, I had to suffer what I suffered. I had to think what I thought. I had to go through what I went through. I had to lose what I lost, I think, to be able to do it. I had to feel like a failure in order to write about success. I think that's true. You know?
Yeah.
I couldn't do it.
I feel exactly the same way. I mean, I couldn't have done it at 25. There would have been no way. Now, I was a journalist when I was in my early 20s, and I did some good work, and I did some good writing. And I look back on some of it, and I think, oh, this is better than what I had judged it for at the time.
Right.
But I also know that it was writing within a very structured format, and I was comfortable with that. And when I would venture outside of that format, I was very qualifying, and I was very insecure of my voice.
Yeah.
And that resulted
in
bad writing, and there was a certain degree of disclarity. And a friend sort of clicked on a switch for me at some point, maybe – I don't know what age I was, you know, maybe I was in my mid-30s. He said to me something to the effect of, you should write like you talk. When you talk, you're perfectly clear and you get across a point and it doesn't sound coarse or extreme or like you're trying to force yourself on someone. It sounds like a perfectly measured, balanced argument that you're making or point of view that you're putting out there. So write like you talk. And as soon as I got that piece of advice, it was as though a light switch went on. And when I returned to writing, I guess it must have been in my late 30s, maybe age 36, 37, something in that neighborhood.
Yeah.
When I returned, I had that ethic in front of me of writing like I talk. And, of course, speech precedes writing anyway.
Yep.
And kids who are 8, 9 years old can string together perfectly persuasive sentences and paragraphs. So, you know, speech precedes writing as a natural matter, of course. And when I grokked to what my friend was saying, it changed things in terms of my writing. It was very freeing. And in a certain sense, everything that I've done since then has been a combination of tremendous rigor in terms of the research that I put into my topics, but also the stripping away of an affected voice, a voice that, as Elmore Leonard puts it, you need to go back to your manuscripts and take out everything that sounds like writing. And it's so perfectly put. And I understood what he meant when I came across that because of these years. It's a process of removing that affected voice that we teach ourselves to think of as writing, you know, rather than just expressing ourselves as naturally as you and I are doing it right now.
That's right. And, you know, I had to teach myself. I'm a guy who had big – we were talking about emotion and how important. I was a big feeling guy, you know. I always had these big experiences. At least it felt that way to me. And I really wanted my writing to express that. And so I'd write the hell out of what I was – and, of course, it never reflected it. And what I have to remind myself, because now I write – I use my own life as the source of my material. I mean, it's just – I write about spiritual matters, but I do it through my own experiences. And the lesson I have in the back of my – or the mantra I have in the back of my head is always, the truth is enough. Don't make it more than that. Just let it – if you can tell the truth, it'll all show through. Just do that. Just tell the truth.
Yes.
It's enough.
Yes.
Not always
and,
so easy.
You know, not always easy, but always identifiable because it you know that you've hit it. And other people get it, And everything else, you know, becomes this artifice. You know, another thing Elmore Leonard pointed out, I don't know why he just happens to be on my mind this afternoon. He made the case that he never used physical description in any of his books, and that he never used, when he was writing dialogue, he would rely simply on the word said. He would never use... exclaimed, insisted,
said,
from the nature of the dialogue, if the dialogue is truthful, as you were just alluding, the reader will know the mood with which it's being said. And you don't need to direct him by the nose to whether someone's exclaiming or angry or what have you.
That's right.
And another thing I've noticed, I don't know whether Elmore Leonard pointed this out or not, but... We can lean dangerously on adjectives when we don't really have the point that we're trying to make in our grasp.
That's
if you're describing a scene of tension between two people, you'll probably never at any point, if the scene is truthful, need to direct the reader's attention to the fact that this is tense or this person's angry or what have you.
That's right.
Yeah.
I agree. A great 100%.
Deal, so much of it is stripping away. I mean, there's people find it difficult to understand that sometimes because it can seem like a paradox. Maybe it is a paradox. I mean, you have to work and work and work and put in tremendous rigor and research and effort, but so much of it goes towards stripping away artifice.
That's
and just
right.
allowing
That's
yourself
right.
to naturally communicate.
An adjective, I tell my students, an adjective is an opinion. But nouns and verbs, and it's okay to have some adjectives. You don't have to get rid of them all, but it is still an
right,
opinion.
Of course.
She was beautiful is an opinion. It's not a fact.
Right.
You know, she had blonde hair is a fact, you know, or whatever whatever it is. And so, and if you rely on adjectives, you, when I find myself relying on them, it's because I haven't built my case in nouns and verbs, you know, whatever the case may be.
I think that's well put. And I also think we have to make sure, and this is probably something you get into with your students, we have to make certain that the words themselves are doing as much lifting as possible, that we're using a term that gets across as much meaning as possible. In other words, if you're going to rely, if you're going to use a verb at a given moment, that verb should be telling you as much as possible as to what's going on. If somebody is lifting a heavy object, then your choice of a verb might be different than if somebody is lifting a light object.
Exactly.
Nobody will find – it won't be obtrusive to the reader, but it will communicate more. Like each word choice should – do as much work as possible for the reader. So you're going to choose a different verb based on whether somebody is lifting a feather or lifting a rock.
That's right. That's why I never quite believed in the thesaurus approach to writing, because I feel like, no, these words aren't interchangeable. Each one is doing something very specific. Very specifically, each thing is doing – there's a difference between hoisting and lifting, you know, and heaving, for instance.
Right.
Well, I had promised our listeners that we would talk about Joseph Murphy. We just started talking about writing, and it's so much fun. I could just go on and on about it. But you are kind of a curator of New Thought writers, and I got to tell you, I'd never heard of Joseph Murphy, and he was writing in the – no, I hadn't heard of him. So he was from the – I don't think I had anyway, but so – but let me see. So the books that we've just – they've just come out or been re-released are – these are by the author Joseph Murphy. These were published in the 60s and 70s, the ones that you Joseph, The Cosmic Energizer, Within You is the Power, and The Cosmic Power Within You. And so he was a minister, an Irish-born minister, who really sort of traveled the country, I guess, talking about what would become Law of Attraction, New Thought now, in this, like I said, the 50s, 60s? When was he doing his work?
That's exactly right. Murphy, he emigrated to this country just before the Great Depression. He grew up on the southern coast of Ireland. And if we thought that times were tough financially in America during the Great Depression, it was Valhalla, you know, compared to kids who grew up on the Irish coast. And he had trained as a chemist, and he came here to America, and he actually maintained a pharmacy counter in the lobby of the Algonquin Hotel in Midtown Manhattan.
The Algonquin?
Yeah, believe it or not.
That's funny.
You know, a hotel that has its own literary lineage
Is
still standing. And Murphy discovered at a young age in the 1930s, when he was in his 20s, that he had a taste for the new metaphysics that was sweeping through the Western world, and particularly America, by which I mean New Thought, Christian Science, all these things that were precursors to what we later came to call the power of positive thinking. The idea that thoughts are causative was the most arousing spiritual idea that traveled through the modern world, and in some respects still is. And Murphy took to these ideas, and he discovered that he had a power and ability to communicate them very simply and very clearly. And he lived for a very long time. He didn't die until 1981.
And
he was an old dude, and he first attained, you know, by that point, he was in his mid-90s. I think he was 95.
Yeah.
And he attained his first large-scale success as a writer in 1963 with a book called The Power of Your Subconscious Mind, which was probably his most famous book and is one of the most successful metaphysical books of the 20th century. And Murphy is a person I see as one of a handful of the last of the pioneers of New Thought. You know, there was a small collection of folks, one of whom is still with us, actually, and that is the minister Catherine Ponder, who were all of a more or less of a certain vintage, and they began writing, or they really came into their career as writers post World War II, and they were kind of the last great communicators of the New Thought tradition. There are still people writing in the vein of New Thought. I write in the vein of New Thought, but these guys, these were the giants. These were the titans.
These
were
the
ones who shaped the genre. Yeah. So I see Murphy as the last of the pioneers, and he occupies a kind of special place in my mind for that reason.
You know, and I think I like the term, although it may not be able to be called that anymore, because I think it is becoming more, it's not so new anymore. I think it is becoming more and more, I dare to say the word mainstream. I think it is, and I think all for the better. Here's an interesting thing. I have a book coming out in May called Fearless Writing. So it's really a spiritual book about writing, and it really is this sort of thinking, but just for writers, how your thinking affects your whole career and so on. It's putting into language for writers. The people who published it, to my surprise, were Writer's Digest books, which I always have I looked upon as a very traditional publisher. Yep. I didn't think they'd be into it. I thought they'd be the wrong. They loved it. They absolutely loved it, which was inspiring to me, because I thought it's got to be in the spiritual houses. They're the only ones who get it.
Right.
No, they were totally on board with it. And I can't think of a more traditional writing publisher than Writer's Digest Books, but they were open to it too. So what do you think of that?
Well, you know, there's a lot, you know, a number of things there. The first is the New Thought thesis that thoughts are causative in many ways has become the American creed. This is something I write about in my book, One Simple Idea. You know, it has traveled our landscape from New Age spiritual centers to evangelical churches, people who don't in any respect consider themselves part of the alternative spiritual culture would agree with that idea. It's inspired presidents of different stripes. I mean, you know, you have Ronald Reagan saying nothing is impossible, Barack Obama saying yes, we can. They're both drinking from that same well in a certain sense.
Yep.
And the idea that the individual has within himself uncharted possibilities that stem out of his sense of self-image, his sense of possibility, the proper direction of one's mental energies, that's a very American idea. So in a sense, to a greater and lesser extent, all of us participate in that idea. Some regard it metaphysically, some regard it psychologically, but it's a part of everyone's life to one degree or another. So
yeah.
It is mainstream. And the question of what to call it is one that I wrestle with. You know, New Thought really refers to the movement as it grew in the early 20th century. I think the phrase New Thought probably came out of the work of Ralph Waldo Emerson, who talked about how we can – he used the phrase, we can redeem defeat by new thought. So he was talking about new ideas within the individual person. And yet the term – it's like the ideas have gone mainstream. The term has never quite gone mainstream. I shy away from I don't like to use the term law of attraction or the secret because people have associations, whether true or not, that there's some sort of passivity involved in all that. And I don't think of any of this in terms of passivity. I use the term power of positive thinking because it's universally recognized, although that can feel like a dowdy or an old-fashioned term. Haven't found a new phrase yet that really captures it. So I continue to use New Thought, which I think at least has historical integrity. But I'm on the lookout, frankly, for a new phrase that I think
if I come up with one, I'm going to let you know.
Let me know, please. I'm open to it. Yeah.
Mitch, you're doing great work, my friend. You're doing great work. Keep doing it. I'm always thrilled to hear from people like you who are out there helping people and doing what you love. It's a great combination. You get to help other people and make yourself happy. What could be better?
Yeah, I'm trying. Thank you, Bill. I really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Oh, it's my pleasure. So, when the miracle of a definite chief aim comes out, I want to have you back on the show.
That'd be great. Thank you.
And
I appreciate
it. In the meantime, the re-releases of Joseph Murphy's three books, The Cosmic Power Within You, Within You is the Power, and The Cosmic Energizer, available wherever fine books are sold, yeah?
Oh, yes. You can find them anywhere. And
excellent.
You can find me at MitchHorowitz.com. And you can find links to various articles and videos that weigh on these topics.
And when do you list some of your public speaking events? If people want to come hear you talk and be able to meet you personally, do you list those there also?
I don't have a running list of public speaking events there. I am going to be speaking at a Freemasonry convention at MIT the weekend of April 1st. So I'll be posting something about that on my author page at Amazon. I was just out at the Flagler Museum in West Palm Beach this past weekend giving a talk on mystic history. But if people follow me on social media, they'll be able to find all that stuff. I'm on Twitter at Mitch Horowitz, and they can find me on Facebook as well.
Excellent. Mitch, as always, it was a pleasure.
Thank you so much, Bill. Pleasure. Likewise.
You're welcome. Oh, that was fun. Do what you love, people. I say it every show, don't I? Yes, I do. But it's true. Do what you love. You can't go wrong. I'll have Jason Rakolcak on next week. We'll be talking about his latest book. In the meantime, like I said, go find something you love to do and just do it and do it and do it and do it. And, well, all will be well. Strange but true.